This is a Triple J podcast.
Every billionaire is a douchebag.
Parliament is a sick place.
I thought, oh my God, I might be an alcoholic. Obviously, I'm an inadequate guest.
If no, that's not what I'm saying.
Who's the Prime Minister?
They're one of the biggest creator groups in the world. Seven guys with a combined YouTube following of more than 100 million. It's actually double that if you include Instagram, TikTok, other platforms. They're spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on a single video, clocking up billions of views. So how do you go from making content in your bedroom as a 14-year-old to having more influence than you could ever imagine? G'day, it's Dave Marchese with you for Hack. Coming up, our chat with one of the Sidemen, Vic Star, on what it feels like to be both mega famous and unknown at the same time.
We sometimes describe it as just a huge bubble. I do feel like there's a huge divide between kind of online culture and traditional entertainment culture, and we sit somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, that big chat with Vic Star coming up soon. If you're a fan, you'll want to listen. If you're not, it's a great insight into the YouTube world and exactly how big it is. We talk about addiction, social media bans, what he thinks the future of YouTube looks like. First though,
this is Hack.
I'd like to announce I'm about to go buy a goddamn submarine and go F off and live in the ocean so I don't have to pay for fuel.
On Triple J.
Yeah, some drastic measures from people, ideas being put forward, buying a submarine. Have you filled up this week? How much did it cost you? Because everyone is talking about fuel prices at the moment. As a result of the war in the Middle East, there are fears of panic buying. The government's saying, nah, we're good, we've got enough. But what are things like where you are? And have these fuel prices changed some of your travel plans? Message in 0439757555. April McLennan's been looking into it.
Yeah, we definitely have a few concerns about the trip being shortened, having to come home and get back on the tools.
Marcus and his girlfriend are heading off on a road trip around Australia.
We're leaving today from a small place in Western Victoria called Gringee Galgona.
But as they hit the road, they're realising the price of petrol could be an issue.
I just looked at the fuel prices in Hamilton, the closest regional hub, and for unleaded, it is $2.20 a litre.
All over Australia, petrol prices are high. Where I am in Port Lincoln, a litre of unleaded is about $2.18. It's a similar story in a bunch of other places we checked today.
I'm in Sydney and I'm actually avoiding fueling up because my local servo is $2.24 a litre.
From far north Queensland, diesel is currently $2.56, up from about $1.80 last time I filled up.
And I live in Alice Springs. Diesel today is $2.76.
From Tilmouth Well in the NT, premium unleaded fuel is $3.44 a litre.
Right, but why? In short, because of the war in the Middle East. The longer answer is more complicated.
The difficulties you are experiencing are not currently as a result of a lack of fuel coming to our country.
So about a fifth of all the world's oil goes through a narrow strip of sea between Iran and the Gulf countries. And Iranian strikes there have hit at least 10 tankers. Australia's Energy Minister, Chris Bowen, reckons Aussies are watching all of that and panic buying.
There is no need for people to panic buy or to order 100 or 200% of what they normally order.
He's also announced a measure to make the fuel we have in stock go further.
Today I have decided to relax the requirements under the Fuel Quality Act, Mr. Speaker, when it comes to sulphur content on a temporary 60-day basis. This will see 100 million litres of fuel extra flow in Australia a month over that time.
Servos might be jacking up prices too, with some politicians calling for a crackdown.
Government needs to get on the front foot with this immediately and ensure that we're not seeing price gouging from the fuel suppliers.
In the bush, people are starting to worry. Nell is a farmer from Yuna in WA.
We got a fuel order just after the conflict broke out. So we were pretty lucky with timing. We still got it at a pretty good price. But then we went to order more for seeding just to get ready. And that order's now been put on rationing.
She's been sending me voice memos from the sprayer.
So just, yeah, making decisions on what's necessary to run and what's really needed and what can be pushed back until we 100% know that we'll have enough fuel.
Back on the road in Victoria, Marcus says he's worried about the fuel price, but is pushing ahead anyway.
In the grand scheme of things, the reason behind the fuel prices being increased is a lot more serious for the people affected in the Middle East, so this is just a trip.
Hack on Triple J.
Yeah, April McLennan reporting there from South Australia. We got a lot of messages coming through. Someone saying, my regular fuel top-up cost $30 more this week. Another person saying, yeah, it's $2.60 a litre for diesel in Canberra today. A truckie has messaged in saying, filling up has gone from $1,500 to $2,200 every couple of days for me. And someone else says fuel price gouging should be illegal. Look, I want to get into some of the detail around this because, you know, we need to know what is happening and why we're seeing these price rises. David Leaney is an international supply chain expert and lecturer at ANU, and he's with us now from Darwin. G'day, David. Thanks for coming on Hack.
G'day, Dave. As a long-term Hack listener, I'm delighted to be here.
Oh, it's good to have you here. It's always good to speak with friends of the show, David. I mean, there's a bit of frustration in the community, as you can hear. People, particularly in regional areas, saying they're paying a lot, but then they're hearing from politicians saying there's nothing to worry about. How serious is this?
It is pretty serious, and it's uneven and unequally distributed. So there is about 30 days' supply of fuel in Australia. Diesel is the one that we're really talking about here, but that applies to aviation fuel, kerosene, and to petrol. But diesel's the one that's powering our farm machinery, our semi-trailers, and our diesel-fueled trains as well.
Have you seen anything like this before, David?
It's actually interesting. We not only had COVID, obviously, which was a big disruption, but just about 5 years ago, in March of 2021, there was a situation where a great big 400-metre-long oil container ship got lodged in the Suez Canal and blocked it off. And that was blocked off for about 10 days. And we learnt from that all the oil was trying to get from the Red Sea out through the Suez Canal up to Europe was blocked. And we learnt how that impacted the global supply chain. We also learned how long it took to clear and smooth out the disruption that it caused. It actually takes weeks and months to smooth the whole system out, and that's what we're seeing right now.
Right, so even if there is some immediate solution to the initial problem, it takes a while for things to sort themselves out. We're hearing from people still on the text line, Andrew from Hobart, saying this all seems like a wonderful excuse for the fuel companies to never drop back to a reasonable price, Andrew says. Another person, and Yasmin says, I'm in Newcastle and diesel everywhere is $2.59 plus. And Hannah in Melbourne saying, I've been buying petrol in $20 increments, hoping that prices will go down, but I'm a sole trader and I'm going to have to raise my prices for the first time in years so I can keep filling my van, paying rent and bills as well. David, the International Energy Agency is releasing 400 million barrels of emergency oil reserves to help out with this situation. I mean, that sounds like a lot, but is it going to last long?
To put it in context, the world uses about 100 million barrels a day. So that's 4 days of global supply. But global supply is not the issue. It's really that issue coming from the Middle East through the Strait of Hormuz, out through the Gulf of Oman. So that's the that area. I'll give you three 20s that relate to that. 20 million barrels a day, 20% of the world's oil. And if that's blocked and it's got to go out via the pipeline across Saudi Arabia and go the other direction to the Red Sea and out through the Gulf of Aden or the Suez Canal, can only handle about 20% of that, so only about 4 million barrels a day. So this is a big disruption.
Yeah, this is Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with David Leaney, an international supply chain expert from ANU. We're talking about fuel prices across the country, diesel prices, everything, the effects of the war in the Middle East hitting people, consumers here in Australia. David, is the government right to say that there is no supply issue here, that it's just about distribution?
Yes and no. It's definitely a distribution issue. And one of the things people might not realise is most of our fuel is shipped into Australia from the north via Singapore. And what's been happening in the northern half of Australia the last month or so, huge rains, huge flooding, much more than normal, sort of 30-year flood records. I live in Canberra and work in the NT, so there's a bit of travel in my life. And we're seeing things cut off in the NT where even the backup roads and the alternate paths are cut off. So that's actually causing a big disruption to fuel deliveries, and that ripples throughout the whole national network. So biggest impact at the moment, yes, it's the war in the Middle East. Second biggest impact, floods in the northern half of Australia, and that causes these disruptions that mean that the fuel's locked up in these bottlenecks and it's not getting out to those regional communities. It's not getting out to the farmers. And that's where you're seeing these really big increases and the shortages and rationing.
Yeah, you really feel for a lot of those top-end communities right now who are dealing with several issues across the board. We've got Adam who says our government needs to crack down on price gouging. Another person saying this is like the toilet paper crisis of 2026. And someone else says they say crack down on the servos, but it was the politicians that got involved in the war in the first place, that person says. David, is there anything we could be doing as a country to avoid this kind of impact in the future? Like, is there fuel rationing, or should we be thinking about our reserves long term and saving a bit more in case we find ourselves in a situation like this?
Yeah, great question. I think there's a couple of things we can do there. One is we've got what's called a strategic fuel reserve, and it's a requirement we have as an international good citizen. And ours is 30-ish days, between 30 and 36 days, depending on the fuel type, diesel, petrol, or aviation. And we've got access rights to more fuel that's held offshore, and that means we can call on that. And we're seeing that a little bit with those reserves being released. That comes to Australia. We're not giving up our reserves, which is so that release of reserves is a good thing for us. But we could be investing more in our in-country storage. So rather than store 30 days across our nation in various places, it's a big investment. It'd take a big infrastructure investment because you'd have to build new storage tanks and facilities and infrastructure right across the country. But what's the price of not doing that? So in the longer term, it might be about increasing our strategic fuel reserve. In the short term, maybe some prioritisation system where we actually give a priority to farmers, give a priority to the people in more regional communities. I'd personally like to see, you know, emergency services at the top of that list, but you know, farmers would be pretty high up there.
Yeah, and we're hearing from so many of them now, David, who are saying they're really struggling and they're worried about what the future looks like. Look, thank you so much for having a chat with us and breaking all of that very complicated situation down. David Leaney from ANU's College of Business and Economics, I really appreciate your time.
Thanks very much, Dave.
Hack.
13 years ago, he started posting clips playing video games, becoming a millionaire in the process.
On Triple J.
What does it feel like to be part of the most prolific of YouTube groups in the world? Because there are several big ones that really dominate all of the views, all of the engagement. And you're about to meet someone from one of them. His name is Vikram Singh Barn. You might know him as Vicstar. What started off as a hobby when Vic was 14 years old, making videos about gaming, has turned into a juggernaut, his own channel, because he's part of the Sidemen, a group that's got a Netflix show, sells out soccer stadiums, does collabs with Mr. Beast, the biggest creator in the world. But Vic is also a DJ. He does shows like Tomorrowland. He's here in Australia this week, and he's spent the last few days throwing himself into Australian culture. He's been putting on the mullet wigs, getting into footy shorts, and I'm so happy to say he's with us now to chat. Vicstar, welcome to Hack.
Hey, thanks for having me. That's quite the intro. I've got to live up to it now.
Vic, this is a big question to launch off with, but how does it feel to be part of one of the biggest, most successful YouTube channels in the world?
I would say quite surreal. It's not something that any of us set off trying to do. We started making YouTube videos before you could even put adverts on the videos. Going from that to, you know, now having so much resource, a team of, you know, 40, 50 people helping us put together videos, it's something we never expected, but it allows us to do so many cool and exciting things and build this community. So, yeah, no complaints.
No complaints. I mean, it's kind of interesting because you're so famous and the Sidemen are so famous around the world with people who know your work really well, but you may not be as well known to people outside of that YouTube space. Do you feel like you've kind of cracked this code of being able to be mega famous while also being undercover at the same time?
You know, I think you're right. We sometimes describe it as just a huge bubble. I do feel like there's a huge divide between kind of online culture and traditional entertainment culture, and we sit somewhere in the middle. We have this audience of people that know us, and these people, they've watched hundreds and hundreds of hours of our content. So we feel like we know them on a personal level. It's almost different to any media that's existed before. And until you've engaged in our content in these hundreds of hours, like a lot of our, you know, really awesome supportive fan base have, it's not quite the same relationship.
I mean, you said it's a big bubble. It's a massive bubble. It's incomprehensible, the size of this bubble. Like, all of the subscribers across socials, it's like 140 million followers, equivalent to being in the top 10 biggest countries in the world by population. Do those numbers mean anything to you anymore?
Yeah, you can't visualize what that actually is or how many people this really is because it is so spread out across the world. But, you know, honestly, we could be a great country if we could just get everyone together, if we could unite these 140 million people, what could we achieve?
He's launching it here right now. Vicstar wants to launch his own country. It's a headline that'll grab a bit of attention. When you started, you were 14 years old. You were having a bit of fun in your bedroom, creating these gaming videos. When did you realize, actually, I reckon I can make this hobby into a career?
I would say it was very much blurred lines. The first few years of making YouTube videos while, you know, doing my studies at school. So I think it took a long time for the confidence to come in to think, one, this entire bubble itself is not going to burst and YouTube isn't just going to become this obsolete platform. And two, I had to pivot the content I was making. I had to build confidence in doing that. It's a scary thing. Thinking, okay, I'm going to pivot my content. This could be the end. This could be my whole audience gone. Found people who'd supported me throughout that whole journey. And that gave me the confidence to then take a gap year. I think I'm on my, like, 13th gap year now. still seeing if I want to go back to university.
13th gap year is goals for a lot of people, I would imagine. I was going to ask, actually, like, have you thought much about what you would be doing if this YouTube stuff hadn't have taken off? Like, where do you reckon you'd be? What kind of job do you think you'd have?
So I've always loved science, especially kind of physics and the concept of space. And I think I would have studied that.
Which is so interesting because people would be thinking, oh, you're super creative. You'd be in some creative space, but you're saying not really.
No, definitely not. There's a lot of a science and maths to YouTube. Every minute we can see how many people are watching videos, which videos they're watching, which country they're from, what age they are. On average, when are people clicking off videos? Which moments are making more people tune into the video?
Well, let's try and give people a bit of a scale of some of these videos that you work on. Like if we take the one that you did with Mr. Beast, the collab that you did, it's had like 40 million views or something. Mm-hmm. How much work and effort goes into that? How much does something like that cost?
Okay, so yeah, that was an interesting time. We had our Sidemen charity football match. Mr. Beast had come over to play in that match, and we thought this is a missed opportunity if we don't collaborate with him. At the time, our videos were fairly low budget. Sometimes, you know, videos would almost have no cost, but we thought, okay, this is Mr. Beast. He's got some pretty mega sets and videos. We got to build something cool.
You got to step it up, yeah.
Yeah, so we hired a warehouse for 2 weeks. We hired set designers to come in and build almost Takeshi's Castle themed challenges, which is a game show we grew up loving. The cost of that was around $500,000 just for one YouTube video, which
$500,000, would that
crazy.
Would that be US dollars or Australian dollars?
It would be US dollars.
That's wild.
For one YouTube video, and that was hard for us to get our heads around, especially you think someone would build a set like that for a game show they're shooting a whole season of. But we were saying, build it one day, filming it for 8 hours, and it's gone the next day, which is different to what we usually do, but it worked.
This is Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with YouTuber DJ Vicstar from Sidemen, one of the biggest creator groups in the world. Hundreds of millions of subscribers combined with all of these creators. Vic, it sounds like you have a lot of fun doing what you do, but I'm sure it's also a bit grueling as well, like a bit of a grind. At the most intense time, how much were you putting into creating content?
You know, at my peak of creating content, I had 3 different channels. I was uploading 5 or 6 new videos every single day. And my 16-hour day would entirely consist of making content. I would wake up, have a quick breakfast, sit down at my desk. I would make a video. I would record it. I would edit it. I would upload it to my channel. And the moment that was done, I would start working on the next one. I'd send out some messages to some friends, say, hey, do you want to record this video with me? And when I felt like I was tired, I would stop, go to bed, wake up the next day and do the exact same thing.
Wow.
Now, the interesting point you made is you said, what was that struggle like, or the grind, so to speak? I didn't feel it at all. So it never really felt so much like work in the early days. And it was actually as the audience built and built and built, that's when it started to feel more like work, because you're thinking, okay, there's this audience of millions of people who are now expecting this content.
Have there been moments where you really have felt the full weight of it and thought, oh, this is not working, or I'm not doing a good job?
Yeah, there's been, numerous of these throughout my career. And sometimes you work really hard on something, you think it's going to be received amazingly, and there's just, there's just none of that. And it really makes you sit down and question, and you have to double down and think, no, okay, I'm going to keep going. You have to shoot and miss to eventually land on something really good. But again, it's been a long career in doing this, and we've developed a thick skin and close friendships that allow us to push through those moments.
I mean, you said, Vic, before, when you were younger and you were creating 14 hours a day, 7 days a week, while you were in that, you weren't even really noticing just how taxing it might have been on you. When you look back now, what kind of impact was it having on your health?
Looking back, it was a little bit crazy. I wouldn't recommend doing what we did. I think during the winter in the UK, there were entire weeks where I wouldn't see the sun coming up because I was on a different time zone and just constantly chasing that kind of wheelhouse of content. Bad diet, I wasn't getting outside, I wasn't getting enough exercise.
Was there ever a time where you thought, am I addicted to this stuff?
I would say it wasn't even a thought, it was an understanding. It was a real, hang on a second, I'm spending too much of my time doing this, I need to focus on friends, family. But I think the more I go through life, I realise that actually to enter the kind of top percents of any space, it almost does require a degree of obsessiveness. And that will only come from a true passion for something. So I don't kind of regret any of those moments, but 6 or 7 years into it, there was this realization that, okay, I'm gonna burn out so much if I don't now find things outside of this space to balance with it.
Vic, I don't know if you're aware of this, but recently Australia introduced this social media ban for anyone under the age of 16, and YouTube was included in that ban. And now we've got other countries around the world, including, I think, England, looking to copy that ban.
Mm-hmm.
What do you make of this idea of banning young people from social media?
It's an interesting one. I definitely see both sides of the coin. If this rule was passed many years ago, I wouldn't have a career. So I definitely can't say I support it. I started age 14. I think it can be a great, great tool for people to learn, network, create. So for that reason, I think a ban is unfortunate. But also, I see the flip side. Algorithmic content, the short form content that's 5 seconds, everything has to be so attention span grabbing, so engaging, hyper interactive. I don't love that. I don't think that's great for anyone. I don't think that's great for me, and especially people who are younger, who, are kind of forming their opinions of the world. An algorithm deciding what they see rather than their own interests, I don't love it, if I'm being honest.
Do you think, reflecting on your own experience and talking about feeling addicted to social media, the harm that may be inflicted upon young people, or some of the issues that young people might be having when engaging with social media, that creators have a responsibility to recognise that and to do something about it?
Yeah, no, I fully agree that part of the responsibility does fall on creators to be mindful of what they're putting out, the messages that they're sending out with this content. But also at the same time, I think it is super challenging because audiences really used to go and seek out the content they wanted to find and then align with the creator that's creating that. Whereas now the entire scene has shifted to whereby this mysterious algorithm decides what people should and shouldn't see. And a lot of creators are purely just chasing that because they have to. They're changing the content they're creating because they have to chase what's relevant in the algorithm, what the algorithm is suggesting and feeding to people. And everything becomes, hyper-optimized and maybe slightly less human. And we try and get away with that with our YouTube content. We try and keep making long YouTube videos, 1 hour, 1.5 hours, real experiences, putting that across rather than this hyper entertainment driven short form content.
You're listening to Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with YouTuber Vicstar. He's part of Sidemen, which is a massive YouTube creator group. You probably heard of them. Someone on the text line now, Corey, saying, I was watching Vic's GTA videos in 2014. Where the group has gotten to now is massive credit to the grind they put in. Long live Helmet Boy, Corey says. Yeah, we're hearing about how grueling it has been. Like, it does take a lot of effort to create all of this content day in, day out. Vic, in recent years, you've also opened up about a really debilitating autoimmune condition. You've been battling Crohn's disease. And it's interesting because other YouTubers have also struggled with Crohn's, including Mr. Beast. How has that been?
Yeah, well, it's frustrating, for one thing. They're researching it. They're trying to work out why it happens. There's no fantastic answers yet. There are partial solutions, but no cure as of this moment. Your immune cells don't recognize some cells within your gut lining. So your immune system attacks your gut, and it can cause, yeah, discomfort, pain, issues. I do have some medication that kind of helps with the condition, but it is an invisible illness, so to speak. You know, you can't visibly see when someone is suffering with this. And it's a challenge because somebody might walk up to you and say, what's wrong with you today? You're so unenergetic. You're not giving good vibes. And it's like, I don't know how to explain to you. I'm just not feeling great. Yeah, and just kind of spreading awareness of invisible illnesses. People with the illness, they can doubt themselves. They can think, wow, is this just me on my own making a big deal of this thing? Sometimes it's not your own fault.
I want to get onto your music stuff now, because that's why one of the reasons you're in Australia and you're doing a few shows. How are you finding the DJing?
Absolutely loving it. Yeah. Complete imposter syndrome, thinking, what on earth am I doing? This is not what I ever set out to do.
What does it feel like playing something like Tomorrowland? Like, you've got so many people watching your stuff all the time, but to look out and see them, how does that feel?
Completely unique and special. I think, yeah, we can sit there on a Sidemen video and say, oh, this one only got 4 million views. That's, you know, we should be shooting higher than that. But then you play a DJ set to 300-400 people in a room, and they're real people, and you see them enjoying and reacting to the music that's being played, and you're part of this experience with them. And it's so special, yeah. Words can't properly describe it.
Where can people catch you here? Have you got a few more shows here in Australia?
Yeah, I'm playing at Eclipse in Brisbane on Friday night, and then I'm playing at the iconic Ivy on Saturday in Sydney, which is a venue I've been to many times in my past. And again, if you told me back then, oh, you're going to play a DJ set there one day, I would have said, oh, that's a funny joke. Okay, let's move on.
Yeah, it feels like you've got kind of a nice relationship with Australia. And I wonder whether, has that come from you building up a big fan base in Australia when it's nighttime in the UK, it's daytime over here, and you're interacting with a lot of those people?
Yeah, I think there's a few elements. I think one is the fact that our YouTube content is so globally consumed. Some of my best friends in the world live here. Some other very prominent YouTube creators here, Lachlan and Laserbeam, and any opportunity I have to come and visit. It's a long time to get here, but if I can get here, I have a great time.
Oh, we love to hear it. It is an annoying trip though, so you need to spend a bit of time here when you get here. What do you reckon is the future of YouTube, Vic? Like, do you think that there are opportunities for creators, young creators, to make the career that you've made in this day and age?
I think it would be astronomically difficult to start a YouTube career now. I think if I were to do it myself, I would fail time and time again. However, there is always a niche, there is always a way to really blow up, and there's more eyes watching YouTube than ever before.
And just finally, I mean, do you see a life for yourself outside of this space where you are Dr. Professor Lord Vicstar, a scientist, mathematician? Can you see that? Is that going to happen one day?
No, this world is this world is for me, and it will continue to be that way. I can't see myself disappearing off the grid and retraining into some other profession.
Massive exclusive for me if you just announce your immediate retirement from all social media right now on this random Australian interview. So good to catch up with you. Thanks for making time for us, Vicstar. Appreciate you joining us on Hack.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
Hack on Triple J. And yeah, if you want to hear the full chat with Vic Starr from Sideman, it's on the Hack podcast right now. I've got messages on Hack's Instagram as well, where there is a video up of Vic Starr. Someone says, shout out to Vic Starr. Another person saying, Sideman, huge. We love them. Can't wait for the Australian tour. Another person on the text line now saying, I'm 16 and I love his videos and his music. Also hearing from a lot of people on the fuel stuff we were talking about earlier. Someone saying the government needs to start planning now for the entire world running out of oil in a few years. They need to start thinking about long-term solutions for those of us who are going to be hit the hardest. Yeah, heaps of messages coming through. Still heaps on Vic Starr as well, but that is all we've got time for on Hack for now.